So, EB, Eric Brown, my good friend and fellow meditator, there are a lot of things that I want to get into in this discussion. I'm sure we're going to jump into talking about meditation, talking about the mind illuminated in general. But what I want to do with you is create a series of discussions all about the mind illuminated, because the book is a meditation manual. It's super dense. It's a book that you could read it like 10 times, go off and meditate, and then come back to it and be like, oh, I missed that thing in the first chapter on, you know, how to pay attention to the breath properly. I missed that thing. It's so dense. It's really one of those books that I would consider to be a Bible, like one that I would get the audiobook, one that I would get the paperback, one that I would get on my phone, and just keep dipping into for more information and depth of understanding. And the other thing as well, that it's a manual or like an instructional. And usually with such books, you are meant to go off and practice what you read. You know, it's not just like a book that you read, improve your state, feel a bit better, then move on to the next book. How well you've understood the lessons in this book, you can verify by your time on the cushion. You know, you can't fool yourself. It's like, did you understand what you read? It's like, well, you know, you can go and try it out. In this particular conversation, I think we should talk about Kulidasa's, John Yates, the author of The Mind Illuminated, what he calls the six-step preparation for meditation. I'm going to give you a quick review of this, and then me and Erica are going to dive into it. So the six-step preparation for meditation is something that I've never done. Okay, so I've been meditating on and off, sometimes periods of very consistent and sometimes less consistent for 6-7 years altogether. And the way I would do it is I would sit down and play my guided meditation track, or sit down and, you know, put my silent meditation track on and just listen to the bells and then get into it. In The Mind Illuminated, he encourages you, before you begin your meditation practice, you mentally prepare for it. And he gives you six steps to do every single time you meditate. When I started doing this, it completely changed my meditation practice. These are the six steps, a quick rundown. So the first step is you review your motivation. Why are you there? And what's your purpose for meditating? You don't judge it, you just become aware and accept the fact of, I'm meditating for this reason. And it could be enlightenment, it could be equanimity, it could just be because I want to be more peaceful. You know, whatever it is, it's fine. The second step is you decide your specific goal for this meditation session. So, like, what am I actually looking to work on or achieve during this session of meditation? The third step is expectations. So you bring to mind the dangers of expectations, and you just think about, like, you know, am I building myself up too much? Am I, you know, underestimating myself? Am I envisioning this is going to be good or bad? And then let it go in the end and move on to the fourth step, which is diligence. So you just commit to the practice. You commit to being there, to be present, to put everything down for the entire meditation session. The fifth step is you do a quick review of distractions. First of all, you review the distractions within your environment. Like, you know, is there going to be a baby that's going to wake up crying in the middle of the session? Is someone going to knock my door? Is the postman going to come? And then you do a review of mental distractions. You know, like, did my girlfriend recently break up with me? Is that going to come to mind? Is there this task I need to do for work that is going to captivate my attention? And then the sixth step is review your posture. So you know, it's a very important thing. You know, a lot of us just sit down and do our meditation, but no, like, spend some time settling in and reviewing your posture. So these are the six steps that I want to get into with Eric, and we're going to talk about how this applies to meditation and then how we can perhaps use these six steps in a broader context. But before we get into that, I want to talk to you, Eric, ask you how you're doing, and get a little insight on what you think overall of The Mind Illuminated and what were your first experiences of it.
Yeah, that was a beautiful overview. Thank you. I find The Mind Illuminated very refreshing. I think that's a That's the word that came up for me, because I think when you start, when you're looking around, you're often presented with a lot of vague, wishy-washy, foggy concepts, protocols, procedures, or you're jumping around, you're picking and choosing, right? You're putting together this kind of Mr. Potato Head version of a meditation practice where you're taking some from this practice and some from this school, and you're kind of doing the worst of all of them at the same time. And it can be really difficult to A, notice any progress because you have no actual idea what you're looking for. It's hard to create consistency because you don't have a technique or a framework or a structure for them. And that's what makes this so absolutely refreshing. It actually maps out a journey, an arc, a set of experiences that you can validate in and for yourself. It gives you a technique, a system, a protocol, a container to actually execute, practice, and train those. And it gives you the scaffolding, the support, the additional like pitfalls that you might run into, something like the preparation list. I've never seen presented anywhere else. You know, people might tell you, oh, it's better to sit on a mat or a cushion or on your knees, but nothing with the kind of depth and consistency that this does. So for all of those reasons, I find this extremely useful. I found it extremely powerful for myself. And something I think we'll touch on is also finding it extremely powerful to translate them to things other than the practice, than just a sitting practice. It applies to literally everything because meditation is a part of your life, right? None of this stuff is separate. So anything that helps you here can help you everywhere else.
I want to just quickly ask you something. What was your experience of meditation like before The Mind Illuminated, like in a general overview? Like what kind of, how did you approach meditation? What were you looking to get out of it? Why did you do it? What did you do? And then what changed for you after reading some of The Mind Illuminated?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of my original response definitely applies to me. I think normally when I speak generally, it's because I'm speaking as my experience going through something. So, you know, hopping around between different packs and different apps and different techniques and different schools of thought, like, oh, I'm going to do compassion today, and oh, I'm going to do open awareness, and oh, I'm going to do body scans, and kind of doing the worst of all of them, right? It either wasn't stuck to long enough, it either didn't have a technique to go alongside it, and I was kind of just sitting there being like, I wonder if this is how it's supposed to go. And again, it was very much like a fumbling around in the dark, essentially, which I think a lot of people who are kind of embarking on their own path run into. But fortunately, there are very established techniques. There are wisdom schools that have existed for a long time that actually do have the form and structure available for people. My original aims, meditation was one of the first things I got into. I got into it mostly out of necessity because I was really anxious. I was really depressed. I was struggling a lot. I had very little control of what was going on inside of myself. And this was a foray into starting to take the reins again of what was going on inside of me. So it was very much outcome-based. It was very much necessity-based. And then, of course, as you get a little more experience, you get a little more comfortable, you realize it's flexible. There's a lot that it can do. And for me, I think a powerful recognition was I also eventually didn't need it to do anything. It was a part of my life that was complete in and of itself. It didn't have to be dependent on an accomplishment of something. Much like I would eat, you know, I would sit. It's just part of what I viewed a day looking like. As I've developed both in and outside of just a meditative practice, it's been extremely useful to come back into this, to actually have a feedback system within it, where actually it's like, okay, look, now I recognize this is what stage one is like, because he has a staged system as you go through the book. And then feeling there's a confidence, there's a core confidence that comes from, okay, I'm validating this experience. I recognize this is where I'm at. I'm going to stay here until I like have this down, and then I'm going to progress to the next stage. And I have a methodology, I have a technique, I have markers, physical markers that I can look for to know that I'm either progressing or meeting that stage. And so it's actually given me a renewed commitment to it, a renewed appreciation for just the depth of the experience, for the gift of showing up for myself. I mean, it's streamlined and focused something that was largely ambiguous and vague going into it, which I think for anyone who's actually serious about this work, you know, it's nice when you can actually say, yeah, you know, I have a very clear path, I have a very clear technique, I'm not just fumbling around anymore. You know, that when that gets embodied, it's like, oh no, I'm actually taking myself and my practice very seriously now. And that brings a lot of kind of vital energy and vital commitment to the whole practice.
Yeah, it's one of those the books that can only have been written by Chuladasa, in a way. It feels like one of those, because Chuladasa has meditated for 50,000 hours. Like, that's like a recognized fact. So, like, never mind the 10,000 hour rule, he's like 50,000 hours deep. Neuroscientist and someone, you know, who's lived. He's been married, he's had children, he's had a traumatic childhood, you know, he's lived, and he's pursued the scientific path. He's also pursued the contemplative path and has been seeking the answers to life's biggest questions from a very young age. And what you said about the structure of the book giving you the sense of confidence, I think that's vital. That's super vital, because there's so much information out there on like meditation and spirituality. But Chuladasa says right at the beginning of the book, it's very reasonable to pursue enlightenment. You can do it with serious practice in 7 years. You just need to dedicate 1 to 2 hours of serious practice a day. And it's like, whoa, that statement alone is huge, but it's coming from this guy, you know, like this guy. Like, it's like, now that's inspiring. Like, that is genuinely inspiring. And if you have any resistance to that idea, if you're like, well, no, I don't think that's possible, well, let me ask you something. How many people do you know that have taken their meditation practice as seriously as an Olympic athlete takes their training for the last 7 years, uninterrupted? How many people do you know who meditate and then review periodically where they're at on their meditation journey? Not just showing up and sitting, but actually like checking in, where am I, how is it going, thinking about it, kind of modifying things, tweaking things, like this continual refinement of attention and awareness through a series of intricate stages all the way to insight. Because honestly, I know a lot of people interested in spirituality, but I do not know any people who've done that with their meditation practice. And I know people that have gone on retreats, and the same thing. I don't know people that have spent 7 years, 5 years consistently meditating in a really structured, organized way. So that's inspiring, you know. And do you have anything better to do with your time? Like, the average person watches, what, 4 hours of TV a day? Like, is really 1 to 2 hours of meditation going to like seriously be something you regret? You know, maybe you should just dive into it, like me and Eric are doing at the moment. What we're practicing with this, Eric can talk more about it, this kind of religious commitment to spiritual practice, because, you know, recently I've experienced some tragedy in life, and I know that it's not going to be the only time that I experience tragedy. And when the storm comes, do you want to be in a position where you haven't been taking care of your attention, been taking care of your mind? Or do you want to be in a position where you've been training? You've been training your equanimity, training your insight, training your compassion and awareness to be there for other people, to be there for yourself, and to think about things and understand things in a way that is ultimately wise. So yeah, can you talk a little bit more about what you talked about with your religious practice to meditation?
Sure. Yeah, this has been something that's been forming, for a few months lately. And I know a lot of people in this space, most definitely, again, you know, using the general to speak about me, had or do still have a huge allergy to the term religious or religion in general, right? It's almost taboo in this space, right? It's just seen as a unnecessary evil for a lot of people, which if you believe anything is completely useless, you're definitely wrong. Like, just everything in life has some sort of signal to it, some sort of utility. And so if you take that lens, like, I started trying to take seriously, like, what the heck, like, why do people find this useful? What does it fill for them? What's the value it can provide? We've spoken just in other conversations, and other just articles and stuff we've put out around the value of chosen structure, of actually putting yourself into commitments. There's a focusing effect. There's a freedom that comes from a structure, which sounds like contraindication. Sounds like, whatever that word is, contradiction. Sounds like a contradiction, but it's not. You know, if you actually have a structure set out for yourself, you reduce the amount of decisions you need to make. You can actually just show up and freely move within this thing, and there's a great freedom that comes from structure. So that's one of the points that I'll eventually weave into the whole answer. There's a second point of, you asked, like, you said that kind of tongue-in-cheek, the do you have anything else better to do? And I actually think one of the values, the deep existential values or benefits of meditation, is actually coming to the realization that no, you actually don't have anything better to do. And yeah, I think that triggers a whole lot of people. And it's like, look, if it still does, like, you should sit more. Like, you should really sit more with just as a practice in general. Like, the way it's been coming up for me is experience itself, just the ability that you have to experience anything at all, is full and complete in and of itself. It doesn't need to be any particular way. And so you should be able to be just as engaged, enthusiastic, comfortable, content in seated meditation as you are in anything, doing work, hanging with friends, music festivals, like, wherever it is. Like, it's the ability to experience it all that is really the only thing that matters. And if you can practice it and hone that skill in a very, you could say, unstimulated environment, like seated meditation, it translates beautifully out into the rest of your life, because you can take that fullness when you're with people, when you're about to start a work task. So that there's a second point there, that life is complete, meditation is complete, your ability to experience is complete in and of itself. And if you don't feel that way, you should sit more to train that. And the final one is, I think many people have felt this, and I think this is one of the things people like about starting to take themselves more seriously, is the states of well-being that you can reach when you actually start to dial things in, right? You know, some people get, they start going to the gym, they feel really good, right? And they keep doing more of it. Or they get out of a toxic relationship and they feel really good and they appreciate their other relationships more. There's a measurable level of well-being that comes from showing up for yourself, from sticking to a structure that involves self-care and self-love. That has been increasingly noticeable for me the past few years as I've done just more and more kind of inner exploration and inner work, and to the point where it's so noticeable that I can't ignore it anymore as a nice to have or a side project or like an afterthought of, yeah, you know, I'll do this if I have time. I'll do this tonight if I feel like it. I've actually decided to kind of switch the hierarchy of priority in my life, where actually my personal practice, my relationship with myself and everything going on, is the most important thing. And everything else in my life, like relationships and work and finances and health, are the supplementary, the nice to haves but not required, and the one thing that is required is just a deep devotional practice to showing up for life, right? And so meditation is one of the pillars for me. Yoga is also becoming a foundational pillar between the two of those. And so the intention coming into this new year, I think the biggest one for me has been, I am taking my personal practices, my sadhanas, my path that I'm using for self-realization is my priority. And I want to approach it with that level of religious devotion. It's not oppressive. It's like a leap towards it with like outstretched arms, like, wow, I really want this relationship to flourish. And when that relationship is, you know, the one you have with yourself in the world, that's a great potential sitting there in front of you. And so, yeah, approaching personal practice with religious devotion has been incredible, and because of that is now taking center stage in my focus and my practice in my life.
On some level, that's the ultimate act of self-love. You know, it's like
I agree.
You know, people, you know, think self-love is, you know, saying nice things to yourself, but really taking a personal practice with that religious commitment is the ultimate form of self-love. It's like, imagine you devoting that time and energy and commitment to a partner, right? Like, that would be a huge sign of admiration and love, and you're doing that towards yourself or your being, and ultimately in the end it's going to be beneficial to everyone. You know, it's like, last time I checked, meditation doesn't make you crueler and less kind and more close-minded. You know, it has these very like outward facing qualities. And the whole point of, do you have anything better to do with your time? I completely agree. And I said that kind of jokingly, but I'm deadly serious about it as well. On some level, I think that if you know about meditation and you don't do it, you are arguably, and I'm not saying this to sound like a meditation snob or anything like that. There are many things like this other than meditation too. But if you know about meditation and you don't have anything much better to replace it with, you are really turning down one of life's greatest opportunities. Like, for real. Like, it's, so let me explain why. For thousands of years, people have been refining a system. Thousands of years. A detailed, difficult, muddy, complicated system of understanding the mind to gain clarity and insight and well-being and compassion. And I mean, like, people have dedicated their lives to this. This is no joke. You know, people have, in monasteries, have dedicated their entire life to practicing, refining. You know, the classic film is Jiro Dreams of Sushi. That's a great film on mastery. You know, this guy dedicated his whole life to becoming an amazing sushi chef. There are many people like that, but with meditation throughout the ages. And they've taken it that seriously and then taught people. And there's been lineages. And it's been refined and refined and refined. And now you've got someone like Chuladasa, who's also dedicated his life to it, has also dedicated his life to neuroscience as well. And he's bringing all of this to you. And it takes 1 hour a day. I mean, it takes 10 minutes a day. It depends on what you want to do. You know, 10 minutes is fine too. But let's just say you dedicate 1 hour a day. That's nothing for this gift. It's almost insulting to turn your nose up to it, because you have the opportunity, you know about it. It's just such a great gift, and you know, for my money, meditation, it on a day-to-day basis can help you with, you know, like the kind of like ups and downs of life, but on, as I mentioned earlier, on a much deeper level, that practice is there for you when you're about to die, you know, and when you're facing the real existential issues of life.
Yeah, and I want to underscore a bunch of these points because it is absolutely central on why it's such a, why it's actually one of the practices worthy of being the foundational pillar in your life. One is, if you can, and you definitely can, find fullness in closed eyes, seated meditation, just sitting with being and sitting with life, everything else becomes just an absolute bonus, right? Your satisfaction or engagement with life doesn't become dependent on like, oh yeah, well, I need a cool job and I need fancy friends and I need all this nice stuff to feel like life is worth it. Like, that doesn't become a question anymore. Life's worth isn't dependent on anything anymore. It never is, but many of us don't believe that. Many of us are like, oh, I need to do these things or have these things or get these experiences for this to all be worth it. And, you know, the slog through life to be justified. But you can actually deprogram that out of yourself. And sitting in the fullness of life in meditation is a great, great way to do that. You brought up a fantastic point of how it translates to people beyond yourself. You know, even just, and particularly what's so good about the Mind Illuminated program is it's actually training attention, training awareness. And you can take that. That is something that just becomes a part of you. So if there are things or experiences or people that you want to engage with deeply, you now actually have a capacity to do that. Instead of being constantly distracted, instead of being whisked away by like random movements on the street, you can actually lock in on people and experiences and show up with full presence, which is harder than we might imagine. That's something that can be cultivated and developed, which is, again, something extremely useful right here. And I think a big recognition is like none of your life is separate. It can be really easy to view this as like, okay, I'm going to go do my little practices and then go back into the rest of life as if they're somehow different, if they're two different worlds. It's like none of this is separate. The work you do here, the benefits you gain, all translate out into the rest of your life. Like again, the focus example I just used and even the preparation steps have been incredible for work sprints. When I show up to actually do work, because I have clear intentions, I have expectations, I know if I might get distracted, what I'm going to do about it. And it's like an immediate translation, an immediate benefit across every spectrum of my life. And again, like this is life level work. This is your relationship with whatever is happening in front of you or in your experience. It is something that is carried with you every moment of waking consciousness, and that honestly deserves a place as a foundational or central presence in your life.
So what we've been doing here is we told you that we were going to be talking about the 6-step preparation process as described in the Mind Illuminated, and that's exactly what we've been doing. We've been talking about stage 1, which is motivation. Right, like everything we've covered so far is like, why would you want to meditate? So that's step 1. That's what we've been discussing implicitly in our discussion, like the reasons why we value meditation, the reason that we show up for it. And here's the thing. What me and Eric are doing, you can do for anything. You know, like, you know, when people say like, I wish I had motivation to you know, go for a run. It's like, you know, you can actually go find that motivation, like really, like, yep. You can just like sit with it and ask yourself, like, what would happen if I went running every day for a month? You know, like stuff like that, you know, like find examples of happy runners, you know, go for a 5-minute run, see how you feel. Like there's a lot you can do to kind of stoke the fire of motivation in you, but it's not going to come to you. You have to go find it. And say you're about to, as Eric said, do a work sprint. You can either just make your coffee and then bleary-eyed look at your computer screen and just start typing away and working. Or you can stop and go, what is my big vision today? Like, you know, not just this session, but like, why am I even working? Like, what do I want to achieve from life? what's my plan here? What's the big idea with this work? Where can I be in 2 months, 3 months, 6 months? Now you're thinking big, and then when you show up to work, there's a completely different energy to it. So I want to move on to the next step, but did you have anything else to say on motivation while we're on it?
A comment more on the six steps overall is, one of the reasons this is so helpful for me is it gives things a definitive beginning.
Hmm.
It creates like boundaries. It creates containers throughout the day. Or because like if you're, you know, if you just crammed in some work and were like, shit, you know, I still have meditation on my to-do list today. And you just like plop yourself over on your cushion and you just hit start on Headspace or whatever and you get going, like there, that's messy. It's really messy. And it's obvious how that translates because you can feel it. You're like, I'm still carrying work. I'm still thinking about this garbage. Like actually taking the, and when you get, when this becomes embodied, it doesn't take very long at all to do, but it creates this definitive container for you, and it can actually clear up a lot of that fog, a lot of the messiness that can often be carried in with this stuff. You let it go. It's like, look, I've got 45 minutes. I've got an hour here. I'm going to be doing this. All of these things could happen. If they do, I know what I'm going to do about it. I know why I'm here doing this. It's not going to be the rest of my day, so I have more time. And honestly, with just that, it's like, oh, okay. So I'm just going to show up and be very present here. And that act of creating the container for it in, God, so like in not a lot of time at all has been, damn, unbelievably valuable for me in the practice. Even just my experiences in practice are so much richer because of that.
What I'm hearing is that there's the six-step preparation allows you to ritualize and place greater emphasis and value on the act of preparing. Yep. So like from modern life, just an example, if you have a party or something, right? A big part of what goes into attending the party, the fun night out, shall we say, is preparing for it, getting ready, you know, like getting, making sure the clothes you're wearing are clothes that you like, or getting in the right mood or putting on the right music. You prepare to go out to the party, you get ready, and it's this kind of like fun ritual that kind of gets you in the right frame of mind so that when you leave the front door, you're ready to go. You don't finish work in an office and then just show up at the party. That's, everyone knows that's like a very strange thing to do, right? Like, this is like, why would you do that? But yet we are doing that all the time with our practices as well. You know, the same with physical acts. If you are gonna go for a run, do you warm up properly? I mean, sometimes I don't, and I always regret it when I don't. You know, just 10 minutes of a yoga flow or something like that changes the entire run. You know, spending some time preparing the music that I want to listen to, you know, making sure that I've got the right gloves and the right hat and the right running jacket, doing those little steps make a huge difference then on the actual run, instead of just kind of like showing up. There is value in showing up and not thinking too much about it, but you can also just show up to the preparation as well. So what I tend to do with the, how I initiate the six-step preparation is I include it as part of the meditation itself. So I put the timer on and I sit on the cushion, and the preparation is part of the meditation. I don't kind of like distinguish it. And you can do both, but I just count it as like, I don't ever meditate without doing the preparation, and I'm gonna include it in that time. So the first step is motivation. Why are you doing this? Why are you meditating? Why are you doing this activity that you know is good for you? You got to continually rekindle that fire. I think Zig Ziglar, there's this famous quote, maybe you can correct me. When you have it's something like when you have a bath, let me just actually find that Zig Ziglar motivation quote. Yeah, so Zig Ziglar says, people often say that motivation doesn't last. Well, neither does bathing. That's why we recommend it daily. And it's really, that's the whole point of the six-step preparation, right? It's just like daily renewal of motivation. So step two is more of a localized goal. So step one is motivation. It's like the grand vision. Where are you aiming? As Eric says, your North Star. Step two is decide what you hope to work on in this specific session. Like while you're here, while the timer is on, what are you trying to work on? You know, and that could be some examples from my own practice. Simple things like, I would like to pay attention as best as I can for the whole session. Or I would like to try and enjoy the whole session as much as I can. Even the very end, the last 10 minutes, I want to really try and enjoy my time sitting doing this meditation. Another one might be, if I find myself getting sleepy, I want to stand up and not kind of, because when you feel a bit sleepy during meditation, it can feel kind of nice and kind of cozy, but that's kind of not what you should be doing. You know, you want to generate wakefulness. So, you know, if I feel sleepy during the meditation, I'm going to stand up and shake it off and then recommit to the practice. Things like that. Those are some examples from my own practice on goals. Very simple, but they really just help me. What about you?
Yeah, this is probably one of the best areas where the whole mind illuminated structure shines. Because I think for a lot of us, like when I first showed up, it was like, I don't even know what a goal in this is. Isn't the fact that I'm here good enough? Like, or like, what should I be trying to be doing? Is there something I should be feeling? I don't really know. Like, there's this whole just ambiguousness to it where you come into the kind of stages and structure that he presents here. And it's like, okay, if you're just starting, go for stage one. If you're at stage one, go for stage two. And there's markers, there's phenomenology, there's language and definitions around all of this. And so a lot of mine has been like, look, I'm going to keep up with the stage two protocol. Like my goal today is to sustain attention and actually knowing what that means when I say it and not just saying it for the, because I think it's what I'm supposed to be doing or what I should be saying. It's actually like, no, I have a language for this now, because a big part of the book as well is actually describing some of these things, right? Highlighting the differences, like attention versus awareness. It's like, do you actually have a sense of what the distinction is between those? It's really helpful if you do. It's really helpful. And so then my goal, a lot of my goals have been like, look, I'm actually just going to do the practice of the stage I'm at. You know, I'm going to renew and commit to this until I feel like it's embodied. And if I'm slipping, coming right back to it. And so just that, like just even having a sense of where it's possible to go has been huge, absolutely huge for my practice. And yeah, the small goals along the way really help with that.
So I want to just give people a little quick insight into the stages. Not all of them, but just the first three. So stage one, the practice goals for stage one is to develop a consistent meditation practice. That's it. It's perfect. It's just aiming low, right? Like, don't be having lofty goals if you can't consistently sit at the meditation cushion every day for like a couple of weeks, couple of months. Like, you know, don't be talking to me about non-duality and all of this stuff if you can't spare 10 minutes consistently to practice. I say that jokingly, but there's, you know, there's some truth to that, right? Like, you know, like start small, start where you're at, aim low, develop a consistent meditation practice, and don't think too much about it. Just show up. Chuladasa encourages people to start off with, say, 10, 15, 20 minutes, and then add 5 minutes a week. So you build up to, he considers a minimum solid session to be 45 minutes. That's like a solid amount, but a minimum as well. When you've got that, then you can start adding maybe a 20-minute session in the evening or a 10-minute, and you just go from there and you'll find your own way. Stage two, the practice goals for stage two is as you focus on the breath, you try to just reduce the time that you are forgetting the object of meditation. So you might initially find that you've forgotten the object of meditation, which is the breath, for 10 minutes at a time. And you just kind of like wake up like, oh, OK, okay, well, okay, where have I been? And then you judge yourself, and you know, don't judge yourself. It's actually great that you woke up. That's also another big thing. Positive reinforcement, being savoring the moments of being awake instead of berating yourself for being lost in thought. So that's the practice goal for stage two. And then the practice goal of stage three is to completely overcome forgetting. So that the entire session, the breath is in awareness. It doesn't always have to be in attention, which is the kind of like the very sharp type of focus. It just needs to be there in conscious awareness somewhere for the entire session. And you don't get lost completely in thought for minutes at a time. That's the practice goal for stage three. And that should keep most people occupied for quite a while, but it's so nice to have those goals set up, because what might start happening is people are kind of mixing them. It's like they have an inconsistent meditation practice, and then they're also expecting themselves to focus the entire session on and not forget the breath. And it's like, let's actually like go through this step by step. Step one, very simple, get a practice. Okay, good, stick with that for a while. Increase the kind of like the muscle of your intention over time by building up to 45 minutes. Stage two, just reduce, you know, and he has techniques in the book that we're going to go into in later discussions, but he has techniques to reduce the time you spend mind wandering. And then eventually stage three out of stage 10 is you're now kind of like a solid practitioner of meditation where you're not forgetting the breath for extended periods of time. Amazing, you know, amazing. What a cool thing to work on. You know, there's clear progress and clear feedback.
Yeah, and it was this actually leads into the next one around expectations and just getting your expectations in check, because it was definitely a hit for me to be like, oh, I'm still at stage one when I started this. I was like, look, I don't even show up every day for this, and yet I'm trying to levitate over here as if I'm like way down the road. And there was definitely a bit of kind of humble soup that had to happen with that. But it was also nice, right? Again, this single orienting moment of like, all right, cool. You know, if I'm serious about this, I now have a sense of where I'm at and where I want to go and what comes next. And the it actually helped when you and I were first talking about this, that we kind of committed like, yo, this isn't going to be a shiny object syndrome thing. Like, this is going to be a long haul, and I'm actually here for the whole thing because I want to focus on depth in my life rather than breadth of stuff. And so actually that overarching, it also ties into number one of like the motivation at large. It helps set expectations where it's like, look, I'm here to show up as best I can right now for the practice, for the stage, but you know, I'm not going to be levitating just yet. And getting those in check it helps a lot, because it makes the little turbulence that you might run into in each session a lot easier to overcome, right? You don't should all over yourself. You don't get disappointed if you're better one day than you are the next. You can recognize that it's a long game, and that, again, there are markers that you can feel and experience and validate for yourself that will help you gauge and move forward and progress. That's I think where the expectations have come in for me.
And the expectations as well, whenever I run through it, I can't help but think of stoicism a little bit, you know, because it's this idea of premeditation, like you're kind of visualizing like, how might I build myself up to something loftier than I am, or how might I, you know, have low expectations and just convince myself before I've even sat down that I'm going to have a terrible, quote unquote, terrible session. And the Stoics were very big on, you know, thinking about that hardship that might come, think about that difficult person you might meet, and then plan accordingly. You know, imagine how you might respond to that with wisdom. And that's exactly what Chuddhadasa has us do here. He has us sit down and think about, you know, how do we think the sessions is going to go? And then the very expectation can just become another thing to let go of before you begin. It's in itself a storyline. It's something to just drop and just to go, well, you know, the most important thing is showing up. And I do think the expectations and the diligence, which is step four, they are like brother and sister to me. They're like two steps that are combined. The expectations and the diligence are put next to each other for that specific reason. You let go of expectations and you just remember that what's the only thing that counts? Diligence. Yeah.
The diligence one has been huge. It's one of those things that confronts you, where it's like, are you here to talk the talk or are you here to walk the walk? And, you know, it highlights that quite clearly for you quite quickly. And it's really helpful, actually, as you're cultivating the skills in the first few stages, because a lot of it is noticing the gap or noticing how long you've been lost. And I think one of the things that happens, or at least that I noticed for myself before starting this and certainly throughout it a little bit, has been like, oh, if I caught myself wandering, like, I fucked the whole thing up. Like, dang, I failed. Like, oh, I'm going to have to try again tomorrow. And it's actually like, no. Again, it's just, oh, you fell down, you pick yourself up. Like, oh, you still have 15 minutes left. Like, let's go. Make those a good 15 minutes. And just that sense of renewing your commitment moment to moment, not just like session to session, not just like week to week, like moment to moment, like this is what I'm here for, is huge. And again, one of the things that translates so nicely outside of meditation as well, just renew. Because, you know, people do this all the time where, like, they're working and they get distracted and it's like, oh, look, I messed the whole day up. Like, I started goofing off. It's like, well, no, dude, you have more time in the day. Just renew your commitment. It's like a stumble. It's not like a complete face plant. And so, diligence has been a big one for me. And just cultivating character traits that I would like to embody more of.
What you're describing here, so there's the skill of meditation, which is training attention. But what you've just described to me is one of those amazing side benefits of meditation, as being this little microcosm of normal life. So, like, you experience a quote-unquote failure during your session, and now you have to deal with that. You have to learn that skill.
Yeah.
How do you not be a perfectionist? And that same skill you can apply outside of your meditation session. Because it's true, one of the, you know, the problems, we've listed many benefits of having a structured system for meditation, but one of the problems is that you now have a way to measure yourself. And if you don't do things by the book, then you can always say, well, I don't measure up. I'm not doing things right. I fail stage three. But really, there really is no, you can't really fail anything in any given session. You know, what if you don't forget the breath for 25 minutes and then you forget it once? Have you failed? Have you succeeded? Well, you have to just feel into it and just look at your general pattern and go, well, I think I would give myself, you know, like, I think I'm ready for the next stage based on that. If you're forgetting the breath every 5 minutes, then you might have to make a different decision. But in the process of training, you have to become kinder with yourself. There's no other way you can progress. There really isn't. Like, because that thought of, if I mess up, I'm going to be a failure, is like, cool, now you're going to be stuck on stage one forever. Like, until you actually relax and become kind with yourself, you're not getting anywhere. And it's like someone saying, like, it's like a cruel joke. It's like, I'm going to force you to be kinder to yourself. It's like, no, I don't want to be. I want to hang on to this story of judging myself. It's like, all right, cool. Fine. No enlightenment for you. It's like, okay, then. I guess I'll be easier on myself.
Yeah, and there's... like, this is still a... It's a practice of showing up for yourself, first and foremost, right? Like, there's no rubric here. You're not objectively failing. But it is such a nice, there's actually a very stoic thing in this for me. It's like, my success is in showing up for the things that I can control, like renewing my commitment, managing expectations. Like, if I do those things and if I actually showed up for the practice today, awesome. If that session reveals to me, maybe a bit begrudgingly, that I'm still at stage one or stage two, that's cool. Like, that's where I'm at. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the frustration comes with the fact it's like, oh, freak, I'm not like a sage yet. Like, damn, son. And yeah, you know, swallowing that pill kind of sucks at the beginning, but you do yourself a big favor by actually accepting where you are in reality at that moment. And the success is just, yeah, you know, I chose to show up. I did the prep. I tried to do the practice as best I could, and I'm ready to do it all again tomorrow. Like, that is success. And that, like, again, it's almost cliche how much I'm bringing this up now, but that translates to the rest of life so beautifully, right? Your work, your relationships, it's like, look, did I show up? Did I do what felt right according to my heart and my values? Yeah, like, yo, I'll take that win. I'll take that win any day. Did it go how I wanted or how I would have wished it? Maybe not, but that's fine. You know, I'm going to show up again for it tomorrow. Do the same thing. Like, it translates so beautifully, so richly into the rest of life.
Totally, totally. It's if you look at successful people, like, you know, whether it's writers or athletes, entrepreneurs, there's always this common thread of, I show up and I do the work to the best of my abilities and let whatever happens happen. Like, that's kind of like, that's it in a nutshell. How do you become a great writer? You just do that. Like, you just do that.
Like, no, that's the show answer up to everything.
Yeah, it really is the answer to everything. Like, just show up, do the best you can. Don't overthink it. Try and improve. Do the same thing tomorrow.
Yeah. And like, we touched a bit early on number five, like just going over distractions, which again, the premeditation thing is huge. Like, oh, my dog might walk in. If he does, okay, cool. I know what I'm going to do. Like, just having that little game plan can course correct so quickly. But one of the really powerful ones for me as kind of a metaphor was the last one of reviewing your posture. The way I took that was like, yes, there's an actual meditation posture that can be very helpful, but it's like this, am I showing up in the right way for the context of what I'm trying to do? If I'm doing seated meditation, am I showing up in the right way? There's an actual posture for that. If I'm showing up for work, am I showing up in the right way, right? Is there shit everywhere? Like, am I at a really busy spot? Like, there's a right relationship to every context. And if you start there, you're way more likely to succeed in whatever you're trying to do. And that, like, has really hit home. Because it's, again, it's like, oh, if I take 30 seconds to, like, prep my space and clean up and renew intentions before starting work, this is going to be way better. I might get, like, way deeper into a flow state, make my work a lot better, enjoy it a lot more. Awesome. I'll take that. Whereas, again, if you just show up, you're kind of slouchy, you're sitting on your bed, you know, just writing stuff out with one hand. It's like, what do you expect to come from that? Like, what do you expect? You're not even showing up for the thing, so why would it show up for you? And so, yeah, that has translated, again, hugely for me as well. Where it's just like, am I in the right posture for what I'm about to do? Am I actually showing up in the right relationship to this? And, like, these things take 12 seconds. Like, once you've done them a few times, they're so quick, but, my God, they are, yeah, really powerful.
There's also this feeling of, for me, at least at first, when I got to the posture part of the six-step preparation, I would want to kind of like skip over it. Like, you know, I've said my goals, I've said my vision, I've said my intentions, and now it's like posture. Oh yeah, I'll just sit up straight, cross my legs, and get on with it. But like you just said, right? Like, here's an example that illustrates the power of this. Jordan B. Peterson. Okay, Jordan B. Peterson, like, you know, if you know, you know, like, the guy has spent like decades as a clinical psychologist. He has written the books Maps of Meaning, and he's one of the top lecturers at the University of Toronto. He used to be incredible thinker, incredibly intelligent, very knowledgeable on psychology, well-being, and improving your life and to develop more of a meaningful life in the face of tragedy and setbacks and suffering. So he writes a book, 12 Rules for Life. This is 12 Rules for Life. You know, this is his epic masterwork, 12 Rules for Life. Each book, there's a short rule that he elaborates on. So you open the book, you get to the first rule. The first rule, this is the first thing he wants you to see. And what does it say? Stand up straight, with your shoulders back.
Oh, good, like, connection.
You know, like, but like, how, like, that says it all, you know? That's not something to skip over, because that's exactly what you're talking about, you know? Like, start with your posture, start with how you're physically showing up, you know? Like, don't be, you can have all the concepts and theory in the world, but if you're walking around not making eye contact, slumping over, terrible posture, fidgeting, shuffling, I mean, yeah, really? Like, where are you expecting to go?
Honestly, like, an example that makes it really tangible for me is like a direct conversation with someone. Like, imagine you walked over to like your loved one or a family member or something. You're like, yo, I have something really important to tell you. And they just like whipped out their phone. They turned their back to you. They like hunched over and totally tuned out. Like, there's no way you can make the argument that they're fully invested in that, that they've shown up. And it's like, those are strictly postural cues. That's just something they're doing with their body. They could very well be like actually listening and paying attention, but there's cues and there's a relationship dynamic to that. And yeah, this actually goes all the way back to like the personal kind of religious practice and devotion to this. It's like, you know, I want my posture to myself to be serious. Like, I want to show up for me with that level of like respect and openness and actually like look myself in the eyes and be paying attention to this stuff. Because, like, why not? If I'm not going to show up for myself, why would anyone show up for me? It's like a vote for your own worth. It's like, if you can't take yourself seriously or with compassion or with good posture, period, like, why would you expect anyone else to? And I think there's almost like a flip side of it where if you show up for yourself in that way, you actually don't need anyone else to do it for you. The only reason you need it from other people is because you don't give it to yourself. And if you just give it to yourself, you know, if you give yourself the love, the devotion, the commitment, the energy, the time, the space, you actually don't need it from anyone else, you know? It goes back to the experience being full in and of itself if you would just show up for it. And it's right there. It's just waiting for you to take it and show up for it.
Yeah. So we've covered the six steps overall. We brushed over distraction a little bit, but I mean, distraction, it's obviously important and applies to other contexts. For example, if you're sitting down about to do a few hours of work, being aware of the physical distractions in your environment, like putting your phone on airplane mode, closing windows if it's going to be loud outside, telling people what you're up to. But also mental distractions, like realize before you start work, like, oh, I'm probably going to want to check YouTube and spend 25 mindless minutes seeing what's recommended for me, right? Like, yeah. Okay, so you're aware of that. Don't do it. Or like if you do it, have like some note open that you can just put a link into the video you want to watch later, or get an app like Freedom or some other kind of distraction blocker. So that's also very good. But now that we've covered all six, just curious, how does one integrate the six? Because these six steps, just to be clear, don't have to take an hour. You know, you could literally run through them in 20 seconds. You know, I probably recommend dedicating a few minutes to it to do it properly. But, you know, you go through them at your own pace. How does one integrate these steps into their life, into things beyond meditation?
Yeah, I think the first one is a conceptual understanding that none of this stuff is separate. The lessons you learn in meditation are lessons that apply to life, right? Things that are going on in your life will carry into your meditation practice, right? The stuff's not separate, which makes it powerful. It means that the preparation steps you do for a meditation practice are preparation steps you can do for anything else, because it's just stuff that demands, or not demands, but asks for your attention and focus and presence. So that, I think, is the very first one. The biggest thing for me has been, like, if I'm showing up to my desk to work, like, stand there for like a second, take a breath, and be like, okay, what's about to happen here? Why am I doing this? Because if you sit down, particularly in front of something like a computer or your phone, with so many highly addictive, highly colorful things without an intention, without knowing what you're doing with it, you will get sucked down every single hole possible for the next half an hour to an hour, and you'll be on your fourth scroll of Twitter having no idea why it is you're on Twitter at all. So that like first breath or two where it's just like, what am I doing here? What am I about to do here? What would I like to get done by the end of it? What could happen, right? Distraction stuff. What do I expect from myself for this? And how do I want to show up? How can I course correct? You know, if I do start jumping onto Facebook, can I just take a breath, close it, and come back instead of acting like I just messed up the whole thing? And like that list can quite literally become something very quick. Particularly if you're in the same place a lot, like most of us are working from home right now. You probably don't work in that many places. Like the potential distractions are probably going to be very similar a lot of the time. So once you have a sense of how you can manage them, like it's just a general reminder, like, oh yeah, this could happen. Cool. I know how I'm going to deal with that. Deal with it. I'll put it to the side. I'll come back to it later. I'll return to practice. Like just the, yeah, I think the, yeah, what is coming up, it feels like a recognition that a lot of this is almost cultivating character traits. Like it's cultivating personalities, like being intentional with what you're about to do. If you can't answer like, why am I about to do this? Just don't do it. Like that is a more of a personality or character trait than it is like a preparation step. You know, reducing distractions. That's something that just becomes an embodied part of you. And yeah, a very easy way to practice and build the skill of it is doing it to prepare for meditation. And then the muscles just become much more ingrained, and it'll translate to workouts, it'll translate to conversations with people you care about, it'll translate to work. It doesn't have to be so forced, it just really has to be practiced.
Yeah, and in terms of practicing it, I think one thing that I would recommend to people is obviously start using the 6-step preparation for everything that's meaningful in your life, like from now on. But also think of it like the next 7 days, like tomorrow, just spend the day focusing on goals. And just contemplate like what are my biggest goals for this? What are my biggest goals for that? What are my biggest goals for this relationship or for that pursuit or that work project? The next day, you can zone in on thinking about your specific goals for the task that you're working on. You know, just like really zone in on it. And then you can go through the 6-step preparation, and obviously the final day, you can just pay very close attention to your posture. You know, how are you sitting on a chair? How are you sitting when you're talking to friends? This is a very useful type of mindful cultivation, and breaking it down will allow you to, you know, not bite off more than you can chew, to use that old phrase.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said.
So this is the first conversation that me and EB are having on the Mind Illuminated, but we're going to keep having more. And the next conversation that we're going to have is going to be on the 5 hindrances or the 7 problems. So those include things like procrastination and resistance to practicing, mind wandering. We can develop that a bit deeper, monkey mind, self-doubt, etc. We're going to go really deep into that on the next Mind Illuminated podcast series. So yeah, I hope that was helpful to everyone out there who has a meditation practice or is about to start one.